Hello and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. Thank you so much for being with us. I am your host, Cy Kellett. And this time we talk about being a traditional Catholic. Confessions of a Traditional Catholic is a new book out from Matthew Arnold with a fine foreword from Scott Hahn. Matthew Arnold is an international speaker who's kind of famous for his no-nonsense approach to Catholicism. He's spoken on four different continents. He's been doing it for nearly 20 years. He's hosted his own radio programs on EWTN and Radio Maria and produced lots of audio and video presentations that have been broadcast and distributed worldwide. Matthew Arnold, thanks so much for being with us.
Wonderful to be here, Cy.
So, Confessions of a Traditional Catholic, but you weren't always a traditional Catholic. So how do we get – let's get to the point where you are a traditional Catholic.
All right. Well, I can tell you right at the outset that it had nothing to do with nostalgia for the old days because I'm a convert to the Catholic Church. I was married to a lovely Catholic woman, my wife Betty, in 1991, and I did not convert. I didn't come into the church until 1996. So, it was when we were going through the process, and when you're a non-Catholic getting married in the church, it is a process. So the priest that was helping us through it was a pretty wise fellow, and he suggested that I take RCIA when the children come along and start having questions. I mean, he knew that I was in no place to want to convert at that time.
Yeah.
But, you have to make a solemn promise that you're going to raise your children in the faith. And so he says, when the kids have questions, take the rite of Christian initiation for adults, which I now teach in one of those wonderful twists of fate. But, when we had our first son, Macklin was born in 1993, and my wife brought him home from the hospital and said, well, are you going to take RCIA?
Uh-huh.
And I said, it's not like he has questions. He can't even hold up his own head at this point. But not long after that, Macklin was not quite 3 years old. And, of course, I always went to Mass with them, with the family, just out of solidarity. Well, and when Macklin was three, he asked his mommy after Mass one Sunday, how come everybody goes to communion except for him and Daddy?
Oh.
And she, being a good Catholic mom, she tries to explain to him that you have to understand that the host is actually Jesus before you can receive. And he says, well, if that's Jesus, where's his hair? And perfect almost three-year-old question.
That is a wonderful question.
It is. It's a great. He had a follow-up, too. He asked about where's his teeth. so you chip off the old block, my son. Anyway, she says, go ask your dad, right? Because she is a wise lady. And obviously, I didn't have any answer for him. So she said, are you going to take RCIA now? And I said, well, there's this priest at the parish who seemed very sincere. His homilies were always very powerful. In the book, I call him Father Magister for prudential reasons, trying to keep everybody, out of the mess that I made of things.
Uh-huh.
But he was a perfect storm for me. This is a guy who had been born Catholic, fell away, became an Assemblies of God, street preacher and door-to-door evangelizer guy, had a powerful reversion, felt the call to the priesthood, went to Rome, graduated summa cum laude from the Gregorian with a licentiate in sacred scripture, and was ordained by St. John Paul II himself.
Wow.
Only to return to Orange County to teach RCIA to me.
Right?
Because as it turns out, she called the rectory Monday morning and found out he was teaching and that the classes started that Thursday. So clearly the planets were lining up here. God's providence was at work in this process. And I had no intention of becoming Catholic at all. But about 6 weeks in, we got around to the apostolic succession, and the penny dropped for me. I'd been a nominally Protestant. I had never been baptized, didn't have any kind of formal religious formation. My family stopped going to church in the early 60s when I was a little kid. So even though I didn't have any religious upbringing, we had a Christmas tree and Easter eggs and stuff. So I had some basic idea. But when I went into RCIA, and they went around the room, said, who are you? Why are you here? And it got around to me, and I just said, my name's Matthew, and I'm only here to find out what you people believe. I have no intention of becoming Catholic. But 6 weeks in, we got to the apostolic succession, and like I say, the penny dropped. I said, okay, they didn't make up this church based on the Bible. Christ founded the church, and the church gave us the Bible, and it all just made sense. It all just came flooding in. My wife told me later that she'd been praying since we met to the Holy Spirit that if I would open my heart just a crack, that he would come flooding in.
Oh. Oh.
And boy, you know, be careful what you ask for, because that really happened to me big time. And I went and asked Father Magister what I had to do to be baptized. And, you know, I sprung it on Betty. I didn't tell her about this experience that I had. And I sprung it on her the next time we went to RCIA. What do I have to do to be baptized? And she started to cry. And then I did, too. And I was thanking Father. Oh, thank you so much for this. And he said it wasn't me. It was the Holy Spirit. And I'd just come to grips with the idea of a personal God. And then the idea that he actually cared about me was really, it was life-changing. So I threw myself in with both feet. Father introduced me to a local Orange County apologetics apostolate called St. Joseph Radio, where I met a young guy from Virginia who was a youth pastor at a local parish, whose name was Tim Staples.
Heard of him.
Yeah. Well, you know, you've worked with Tim long enough to know that he is capable of lighting a fire under someone.
Right.
And he really helped me a lot in my conversion process. And then, you know, the oil was still wet on my forehead when I wound up leaving the entertainment industry and going to work for St. Joseph Communications with Tim, producing his radio show, and then a year later getting my own radio show with Scott Hahn on EWTN. So threw myself in with both feet. Now, and that's a long preface, but the point is, without that, the rest of it doesn't make sense. Because why does a conservative, you know, Catholic apologist wind up at the traditional Mass and then outside the diocesan structure?
Right.
You know, how does that happen?
That's what I'd like to know, yeah. But maybe I should ask you to clarify. It occurs to me that we may have listeners who don't know much about the internal vocabulary of the Catholic Church. So they'll be saying, well, what is a traditional Catholic? What are these people talking about? So you became a Catholic in the normal course of things and went to a parish connected with the diocese, and all that is very, very normal Catholic stuff.
Right.
What is it? So when you say you became a traditional Catholic, especially for those who don't know what that means, what does that mean?
Well, traditionalism, while it has a long history, going back to the beginning of the liturgical movement in the 19th century, traditionalism was primarily a reaction against the changes in the liturgy and other aspects of Catholic praxis after the Second Vatican Council. It's people who just, you know, essentially begin with saying, look, I just want to be Catholic in the way that my parents and my grandparents and my patron saint were Catholic, right?
Yeah.
It's they cling very much to all the various things that had been said about tradition. Of course, you know, you have to make a distinction. We talk about sacred tradition and tradition with a small t, you know, and you come to realize that in liturgical matters, of course, the Pope is the supreme legislator. And so, you know, I never had any problem reconciling the traditional teaching of the Church with the new Mass or Vatican II or anything else. And, you know, a quick perusal of the Catechism will tell you that the truths, the doctrines of the faith have not changed, and they don't have any expiration date, right?
Yes.
But for a traditional Catholic, there are people who in large part, are fleeing from not so much the Novus Ordo itself, which, as I say, I didn't have any problem with the new Mass, Novus Ordo Missae in Latin, new order of the Mass, but I had a problem with abuses. You see, I was brought into the Church at a conservative little parish with a wonderful teacher and a wonderful pastor, and in the natural course of events, you know, the pastor retired, the priests got reassigned, and they brought in a new crop of people, and suddenly I started experiencing personally some of the horror stories that I heard from around the country about, you know, abuse of the liturgy and heterodox homilies and dissent-ridden catechesis and so forth. I had kids in the school now, you know, and all of a sudden, all of that was brought home to me in a very dramatic way. And so when I lamented all of this to a friend here locally, she suggested that I go to another town like 20 miles away where they were celebrating the traditional Mass under the Ecclesia Dei indult from John Paul II, right? He had given permission for the traditional Mass to be said for people who were attached to it. So Betty and I went there expecting a bunch of old folks, right? You know, and she left the kids at home because she was afraid they might act up, and you know that you can hear a pin drop at the traditional Mass, right, which is all in Latin, and the priest facing the altar, and there's incense, and it's all very, very dignified. And that's the... that was the thing that drew me to it. You know, we went to that first Mass. I asked Betty, what do you think? And she came out and said, I feel like I've been to Mass for the first time in my life.
Wow.
And this is a fervent cradle Catholic.
Yeah.
You know? So it was, you know, it was something of a pearl of great price that we discovered. And, you know, we eventually became registered parishioners there. Unfortunately, when that pastor retired, they retired the traditional mass with him. And so we were caught in this place of going, you know, to whom shall we go, right? That's the question. And we actually wound up at a chapel with a, you know, a properly ordained priest who was ordained in one of the priestly societies that's intended for the traditional mass. And I tell the whole story in the book, and it's a long story, but we went there just to have that reverently celebrated mass, to have that place where you can go and understand that the mass is not about the congregation, it's not about the priest, but it's about offering the sacrifice of Christ, Almighty God.
And over the last few decades, this has been a common feature of the Catholic Church, people looking for a more reverent celebration of the liturgy, finding the older missal mass, the mass celebrated as it was around 1962 and before, and then sometimes coming into conflict with their local parish or their diocese or with church institutions. And so in a way, and I think this is, might be how you phrase it in the book, in searching to be more traditional Catholics, they find themselves at odds with the Catholic Church. So it's a tough position to be in.
Well, and here's the thing. I mean, if we want to get technical, and really we should in an important question like this, they're not really at odds with the church so much as with a maybe a mistaken understanding, or maybe a you know, Benedict XVI himself, when he put out the Motu Proprio Summorum Pontificum in 2007, which kind of liberated that celebration of the traditional Latin Mass, he sent a letter to the bishops to accompany the motu proprio to kind of explain why he was doing it. And one of the things he said was that many people, you know, wind up exiting the diocesan structure precisely because the new mass isn't being celebrated according to the prescriptions of the new missal. You know,
yep.
That it's not the new mass per se, but abuses things that really shouldn't be happening, you know. That's one of the reasons that people do. They go looking for this thing. Unfortunately,
Would you say, Matthew, that there's that? Okay, so now I'm recalling. It's not a question then always for this person who wants to celebrate the mass reverently and according to the older tradition, of either stay in a mass that's, you know, perfectly licit and well done, but it's the Novus Ordo Mass, or go and into this illicit situation, but that maybe a sense that there is no licit option for me because the Mass is being celebrated so irreverently and really kind of quirkily, maybe, in many places. It's got all its,
right,
the quirks of whoever the local priest is. And so the person ends up feeling it's not a matter of stay where the Mass is being celebrated faithfully and in union with the bishop, or go to this illicit thing, but that there isn't an illicit option for the person. Is that how many traditionalists feel?
Well, that would be the justification, yes.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of times you can go to a Mass that seems pretty lax, that's really only following, you know, using any of the many options, and just choosing to use the ones, you know, that make it the shortest or whatever, you know, and it's still perfectly licit and wonderful. I can tell you from my personal experience, if I had the option of a licitly celebrated, or at least in my opinion, licitly celebrated Novus Ordo, I never would have gone to the traditional mass in the first place.
Right.
I never would have sought it out. I mean, I was a lector. You know, I embraced the mass with the guitar music. I even supplied the guitar music sometimes. You know, it wasn't an aesthetic choice. It was a matter of going to, well, you know, I'll just give you one particularly egregious example. We had a priest that came to our church when they changed the staff around. And when he would get to the Agnus Dei, right, where the priest holds up the host then before the people after the Agnus Dei and says, "This is the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world." And at the time it was, "Happy are those who are called to his supper."
Yeah. Right?
That's the old translation. And he would improvise that prayer, and he had the habit of holding up the host and saying, "This is Jesus, who became a piece of bread for us."
Oh, yeah.
Now, which is not only is that an abuse, because you should be saying the prescripted prayer, but it's 180 degrees from the doctrine of transubstantiation.
Right.
This is flat out wrong. And he refused to be corrected. And, you know, appeals, you know, you try and follow that. You go to the person, take two or three, go to the church kind of thing. And it fell on deaf ears. And that, among some other things, if you read in the book, was kind of the straw on the camel's back for me.
Do you think it's fair to say, as you do say, I'm going to quote you back to yourself at the end of the book, that you say, "The truth is many of today's faithful are profoundly estranged from the devotional atmosphere common to their ancestors." Is that true?
Well, if you happen to go to a parish where they're doing the 40 hours devotion and making the First Fridays for the Sacred Heart and all that stuff, and their entire life revolves around the liturgical seasons, then it wouldn't be true.
I see. Okay, right.
However,
good luck finding that parish.
Good luck finding that parish, yeah. The other thing is that the point of the liturgical movement, really 100 years, starting really within mainline Protestantism back in the 19th century, and then coming into the Catholic sphere through the work of Dom Prosper Guéringer, who did a lot of work in restoring Gregorian chant and wrote a wonderful kind of a magnum opus, multi-volume analysis of the liturgical year and so forth. He did a lot of great work in recovering kind of that pre-Reformation understanding of the liturgy. And that was really, the Anglicans were looking for this, and it entered into the Catholic sphere. And strangely, Pius X himself was very much a standard bearer of the idea of what became a watchword after the council, which is active participation. It was about the people, you know, saying the responses and being engaged and reading the prayers in the missal or learning them in the Latin, you know. And that was the emphasis has always been on education. And it wasn't until after the Second Vatican Council when the idea came, well, we're just going to reform the whole thing. It's going to be entirely in the vernacular, and it's going to be, and we're going to make everything, you know, it's kind of bring down to and this may be unfair, but to a lowest common denominator kind of approach, right?
Well, I'm sure it's not unfair everywhere. I mean, many of the things that happened in the 1970s and probably continued in many places even to today were and are outrageous. They don't comport, as you said, you know, saying things like, "Jesus became a piece of bread for us."
Right.
They are in fact outrageous, and you can and you don't blame people for being outraged at them. As a matter of fact, it's probably a blessing to be outraged at these outrageous things. But you end up then, okay, so you want the traditional liturgy, not for some nostalgic sense, not because it was the mass of your childhood or something like that, but because you see there a real reverence for the Lord in the liturgy. And a real, but that leads you to a position where you are at one point employed by a Catholic apologetics institution at St. Joseph's Communication, but you're not going to Mass at a Catholic parish.
Yeah, at a diocesan parish. That's right. And it's interesting because you have, on the one hand, you have this tension. So I was, I told you that I met Tim Staples during my conversion, right? You know, so I very much got into apologetics, and he pointed me to resources like the Dewey Reams Bible and the Faith of Our Fathers by James Cardinal Gibbons, and Catholic Church Has the Answer by Paul Whitcomb. Those are the resources that I really cut my teeth on when I first came into the church, and of course, Life is Worth Living by Archbishop Sheen, right? That kind of convert course that he did on audio. Back in the day, and it was back in the day, and so it's like, wow, I got that. That was very much my formation, and then there's also this very Orthodox priest who had been, ordained by John Paul II, who came to our parish and was himself not happy with, kind of queasy with the way things were in happening in the church, and so there was this tension between what I knew to be the official teaching of the church on the one hand,
right,
and then the practical application of it, what I was hearing and experiencing in the parish on the other. They were two different things. You know, and that's, and it's not that the doctrines of the church changed. It's not that the, you know, I mean, the emphasis certainly changed in some areas, particularly in the liturgy, but the doctrines weren't any different. So how could people be doing these things that are at odds with those doctrines? You know, and oftentimes, unfortunately, those things were justified by appeals to the Second Vatican Council, or to its ill-defined spirit, right? The spirit of Vatican II. That's, this is, this isn't what the Father said, but surely this is what they would have intended if they'd been me, I guess, is mm-hmm. the spirit of Vatican II. So, you know, and it was that, but then by winding up outside of the diocesan structure, I have that tension in reverse. Because how are you a traditional Catholic? You know, when was it ever traditional to set yourself up, your own apostolate, over and against the local ordinary? You know, what's traditional about that?
Mm-hmm.
So it was just, I exchanged one tension for another.
And so,
and thanks be to God, you know, Pope Benedict was so helpful.
He was.
With my understanding and with the whole church.
He was, yeah, the his own document on issued on his own initiative as Pope changed the scene really around the world, and it made it easier on the person who does want to celebrate the older form of the liturgy, but that's not all that changed your view. I mean, one of the things that will last with me from your book is that you have introduced me in a serious way to Our Lady of Good Success, who I didn't know about her. And so I know there's probably many other things you would wish that I would take, but that just hit me like a thunderbolt. And so can you talk a little bit about her role in your growing return to, I don't know how you'd say it. Would it be fair to say full communion with the...
Communion is the word. That's the very term I would use.
Okay, fair enough.
Yes, indeed.
So what's her role?
I never felt... well, if it weren't for the Blessed Virgin Mary, I wouldn't be Catholic. Let's start there.
Mm-hmm.
After my conversion, my wife told me that she'd been praying for me ever since she was a little girl. And we met in our 20s. I said, well, that's a pretty good trick. How do you manage that? You know? And she said that at 7 years old, and I love my wife, at 7 years old, she discerned she did not have a religious vocation. So she decided that what that meant was that she would be a wife and a mother. And so she started praying every day for the man she would marry someday. Right? And she didn't know who that was, of course. I certainly didn't, but God did. And so she was praying, you know, a Hail Mary on for that intention. And, you know, when I took RCIA, one of the things that Father Magister did, which would be considered really radical, I think, in a lot of places, he said, I don't think 8 months is enough to teach you everything you need to know to become Catholic. So since we can't have more time, I'm going to sacrifice the first 20 minutes of every class. We're going to pray the rosary together on our knees, asking the intercession of the Blessed Virgin with her spouse, the Holy Spirit, to enlighten our hearts and minds. So I was praying the rosary, kneeling.
Whoa.
Before I was even baptized. You know? And it was those prayers, the prayers of my wife and the Blessed Virgin Mary were completely efficacious for me. I have no doubt that if it were not for their intercession, I would never have been in a place to be able to accept the gift of faith. So Mary's really important to me. And Mary of Good, but I never got into any of the apparitions, or right? Even Fatima and Lourdes, Guadalupe, all those things that are very stable and very, you know, approved by the church and all that stuff. So many people... Well, even a legitimate Marian devotion can support a fringe element, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And there are any number of Marian devotions that are not so legitimate. And as a result, I was bombarded almost daily when I worked at St. Joseph Communications. You know, I get these letters and emails and phone calls from people telling us what we had to do with our apostolate because Mary said this and that, and, you know, and she appeared on a pancake in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, and, you know, whatever.
Right, right.
And yeah. So I'm going to look on Daily Rosary, Angelus, I'm good, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm devoted to the Blessed Virgin, not under any special title or anything, but, you know, I pray the litany, but I'm just devoted to Mary. But Our Lady of Good Success kept coming around, and I blew it off because I couldn't, back in those days, this is the turn of the century, I couldn't find anything out about her. You know, there weren't any websites about Our Lady of Good Success, or, you know, I mean, there was nothing available. that I could find through the usual channels. And but then in 2006, I was at the chapel, you know, the traditionalist independent chapel, and there was a book about her in the bookstore. I said, oh, it is legit. And so I bought it for Betty for Mother's Day. And she read it and said, you have to read this, you know, because it's a fully approved devotion. And it started in Spain and actually in Belgium in the 1400s and then to Spain and then came to the New World. And Our Lady apparently appeared to Servant of God, Mariana of Jesus. She's on her way to canonization. And told her about these things that were going to happen in Ecuador and in the larger church and the world in primarily in the 20th century. And she talked about this great crisis of faith and all these things that were going to happen. But she also promised her, quote-unquote, good success. The Spanish buen suceso really means great event. And she promised there would be this great event that where the faith of the church would be restored after the 20th century. And I'm going, wow, this is a great note of hope because it's not about the end of the world. It's not about everything comes crashing down. It's about how, through her intercession, things are going to get back to normal. And I just, it was very profound for me. And, of course, the traditionalists love this because it throws the church under the bus, you know, about how bad everything's going to get in the 20th century. It said, look, 400 years ago, Our Lady said this was all going to happen, and look, it all did, right, kind of a thing.
Right.
But I went down to Ecuador. You know, I made a documentary film about it, and I went there partially to bolster my traditionalism. And as I knelt in that convent church in front of this miraculous statue in the Blessed Sacrament and said to Our Lord and Our Lady, I came all the way to Ecuador, you know, I'm listening.
Yeah, right? here I am.
Yeah, I didn't hear any voices. I didn't have any apparitions or anything. But interiorly, I got this message, I guess is the only word I can use, from Our Lady to say, the people of Ecuador have the faith. I said they would always have the faith. And there's no traditional mass here except the one that your group brought with you. And we'd brought a traditionalist priest to say mass for us. And that was it. You know?
Wow.
And I'm going, well, gee, if Mary can somehow function within the institutional church, you know, if these sisters can stay, remain faithful, these people, I met some of the peasant people that were very devoted, and they hadn't heard a traditional mass in 50 years, you know, 40 years, I guess, at the time. And I went home with this conviction, I've got to get back and bring my family back into the institutional church. It's important. It just has to happen. And it was not an easy process. But then again, Benedict XVI comes to the rescue with Summorum Pontificum. When I found that there was a local parish that was going to say, have the traditional mass every Sunday, you know, I left a skid mark on my way back into the church.
And so, and did many others? I mean, so you're part of a community of people who are in the traditionalist community.
Right.
Did many others come rushing back as well?
Some did, but comparatively a handful. And that's the danger. That is the danger of the traditionalist movement. That's the danger of stepping outside the diocesan structure. Because you wind up in that place of tension, right? And so your justification to say, I'm a traditional Catholic, I just do things the way they've always been done, but I go to a chapel that's not in union with the bishop.
You know? Yeah.
So how do you reconcile that? Well, your justifications, it's just human psychology. Your justifications have to get, you know, deeper and more profound. And what starts as maybe a search for a reverent liturgy becomes a badge of identity.
So, you know? Yeah, right. So it becomes kind of a vice that tightens rather than...
It is. It's to prolonged absence from, you know, the larger community. Some people absent themselves from the community, and right, it's like it goes all the way back to the Book of Acts.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of the book made me feel that I should be less complacent about liturgy, and I think for people who are maybe you know, basically Novus Ordo people going to mass in their parish and all that. That seemed to me a challenge that you wanted us to take up more of. And then at the end of the book, it does make that turn where you make that turn, where it's not a matter of just lecturing those of us who may be lax in our appreciation for and also our celebration of the liturgy and our insistence that it be beautiful for the Lord and for mm-hmm. and for everyone who comes. But so there's that bit of – did you see that as your two audiences, really, those of us who need to be encouraged to take liturgy more seriously and those who needed to be encouraged to take unity more seriously?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the lesson that I've learned, is that those two things go hand in hand, and they're important, you know. I'll tell you, when I made my journey outside the diocesan structure, when I came back in, I was working on a project, and then I got together with Scott Hahn, and he said to me, you know, I mean, I told him about what had happened and, you know, how I'd come back and all that, and he said to me, don't write a book. Don't go on a lecture tour. You know, just be Catholic.
Mm.
And then a couple of years ago, he called and said, you know, I think it's time for you to write that book.
Oh, really?
So again, it was his impetus that helped this get off the ground. And I said, you know, and it was largely because I take a large section of the book to really refute some assertions made in a 2009 book from the Society of St. Pius X, which is a traditionalist priestly society that is outside right. the diocesan structure. And they kind of, they would claim that, you know, in that book that according to the teaching of the post-conciliar of the church, the mass is no longer a sacrifice. And that's, you know, it's silly on its face. I mean, it's right, easily refuted through the catechism and so forth. But you know, unfortunately, they have recourse to these kind of dissenting theologians who make it easy to say, oh, look, here's all these people in the church and they're saying all these things and they're, you know, that are not in line with the official doctrine of the church or whatever. And of course, some of that's even cherry picked, but it was intellectually, it was dishonest.
I see.
And Scott was saying, I think, you know, somebody needs to take to answer that, but it has to be somebody who's been through it.
Right.
And I said, well, the only way I can do that is if I tell the whole story. And that's, I'll tell you something, Si, that's, I didn't particularly want to do that. You know, in the beginning of the book, there's a quote from St. Bernard of Clairvaux about humiliation. And it is, I got hit with a humble stick pretty hard over all of this. And it wasn't easy to write this book, but when somebody outside of, you know, my own little circle says, you know, this would be of value. You know, that's the spark that I needed to say, okay, I'll roll my sleeves up and just relive it all.
Right. Okay. So it's not, but I suppose for all of us, if we tell the true story of our journey with the Lord, it's a story that involves us coming to the realization that we're not so great and we don't know that much.
I mean, right.
At some point, the truth must come out, I suppose. And so, yeah, so I see how, yeah, you don't want to go through that kind of mortification, but it is important. And I wonder how you feel today in 2017. Would you say to a person who maybe was where you were years ago, enough has been done and there is a place for you to be who you are and to celebrate the Mass how it should be celebrated and how you want to celebrate it in the Catholic Church, come home and do that here? Or are we not?
Absolutely.
Oh, we are that far along.
Absolutely. And even, you know, for the person who's, and I understand that they're reticent, you know, I mean, to be fair, well, two things. First off, after the Summorum Pontificum, the majority of Catholics today who assist at traditional Masses do so under diocesan auspices in full communion with the local bishop and the Pope and the hierarchy.
Right.
There are more people going to traditional Masses in union, in full communion with the church than there are people outside at this point, which is already a good thing. But the second thing is, even if you don't maybe have that, laicity is not something to be sneered at. You know? You can say, well, this is a valid Mass. It's like, yeah, okay, it's, you know, there's lots of things that are a valid Mass. You know?
Right.
But
that's a very low standard to say, well, it's valid.
Precisely.
Yeah, okay.
Precisely. So, you know, and I understand, you know, for me, when I was in that space mentally and emotionally, that the idea of, you know, just going back to the balloons and butterfly kind of liturgies that I had been experiencing would have been really, really difficult for me, you know. But yeah, the option does exist now in so many places and more all the time. You know, so and that's another thing. The traditionalist movement is growing, but it's growing within the church, not outside of it. And that's the important thing to note. And that when Benedict XVI, both the encyclical or the Motu Proprio, and when he wrote the letter to the bishops, it was with perhaps not a synthesis like Cardinal Seurat has lately suggested, but at least with the understanding that both forms of the Roman Rite can coexist and be mutually enriching, that they're good for each other. You know, it is good to have both.
And do you,
that there's something to be learned in both directions, you know.
Do you think that's happening? Do you think that 10 years on there is some of that?
When I was in, I went to Australia a few years ago. I got invited down there to give a keynote talk at a fundraising dinner. And when the news got out that I was going to be there, people started piling on. And before it was over, I was there for a week, but I gave 9 different talks in 9 different locations.
Uh-huh. You
know? So it was a whirlwind, and it was great. But the group that brought me there in the first place and I stayed with, they are priests that do both forms of the Roman Rite. And I commented on how, you know, the extraordinary form, as Benedict XVI called the Latin Mass, the traditional Latin Mass, was very beautiful and very reverent, but so was their Novus Ordo Mass. And one of the young men there who was serving the Mass asked if that was unique to them or if I was seeing that, you know, around North America. And I told him that I did see that these parishes that have both forms of the rite, you know, the Novus Ordo Mass typically gets more sober, and then you find there's more and more community involvement too. You have Eucharistic adoration, often perpetual, and long lines for confession, and a sense of community. And that's one of the things. Community comes from the ground up. It can't really be imposed. With all due respect to the people that are trying to foster community by telling people, oh, to use this program or do this activity, you know, it really is something that needs to come from the people themselves. They need to be drawn to, you know, the worship of God and the relationship with Christ before they're going to have that relationship with each other.
I wonder how much of that involves too that the people who waged the wars of the 1970s that were so much part of my growing up as a Catholic are bit by bit out of the picture, and maybe that allows for people not to see everything as a clue to your, you know, you're on that side, you know, it's maybe less,
right.
There's allows for less tribalism as far as liturgy.
Sure, yeah,
goes.
It's not as confrontational.
I hope so.
And I really see, I see the those who would carry the banner of dissent, there is a definite graying among them. You know, they're not, I don't think that dissenting Catholics beget other dissenting Catholics. I think they beget non-Catholics. So, you know, people that are coming in are the ones that, as always, are going to be drawn to the beauty and the dignity and the truth.
Right. That is a perfect line. I hope you've written that down somewhere, because that is exactly...
I have no idea what I just said.
Oh, you better go back and listen to this, man. You just hit it right on the head. I want to remind the listener, we're talking about Confessions of a Traditional Catholic, Matthew Arnold's latest book with foreword by Scott Hahn. You can get it at matthewarnold.org, where you can also learn all sorts of other stuff about Mr. Arnold, matthewarnold.org. It's published by Ignatius Press. And you can get it at Ignatius.com as well. Don't forget, Matthew just reminded me of this before we went on the air, to visit your local Catholic bookstore, though. If you can pick it up there, all the better. Support your local Catholic bookstore. Confessions of a Traditional Catholic. Matthew Arnold, I hope we end on a note of hope, because the book does indeed end on a note of hope. And thank you very much for it and for this time you've spent with us.
Thank you very much, Si. It was a pleasure to be here.
Again, Confessions of a Traditional Catholic, Matthew Arnold's latest book from Ignatius Press. Get it at matthewarnold.org or ignatius.com. I am Si Kellett. This is Catholic Answers Focus. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you next time right here.